This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, it's that time of the year again, and we're talking about the North American International Auto Show. That's quite the buzz around the great state of Michigan, the Midwest, and across the United States. And to that end, we welcome back to Greening of the Great Lakes, Mark Phelan. Mark is the highly respected Detroit Free Press auto critic. And Mark, as we emerge from the deep freeze, looking forward to the auto show?
Absolutely. It's going to be a terrific show. There's a very wide variety of vehicles that were introduced there. We had a couple of days earlier this week where journalists and executives from car companies and automakers all over the world were here to show us the new stuff, and there's definitely vehicles that are going to catch people's interest and a lot of good stuff to be seen.
Yes, I noticed reading some of your articles, but some of the new vehicles that will debut, I mean, the 2015s, there are quite a series of those. Is that more than normal?
We're still coming out of the slowdown in vehicle introductions that followed the Great Recession. During the bottom of the economic crisis, a lot of car companies sort of delayed some of their new vehicles. So we're a little bit probably above the normal number of vehicles. But what's more significant really is the fact that there are some very, very important vehicles that are debuting this year at the show, like the new Ford F-150, you know, the best-selling truck in the country, best-selling vehicle in the United States, and they've made some huge changes to reduce its fuel economy. So that's one of the big stories of the show this year. To reduce its fuel consumption and improve its fuel economy. I got that backwards.
Your Free Press Car and Truck of the Year this year, the 2014 Corvette Stingray and the Silverado pickup. Why those?
Because they're both benchmarks in their segments in different ways. Pickups are tremendously important. They're the best-selling type of vehicle in the country, with millions of them delivered, you know, every year, and they're used by such a wide variety of businesses and agricultural interests, as well as the people who have them just for their personal use. When you've got a new pickup like the Chevy Silverado that manages to both be more fuel efficient, more ergonomic, more comfortable, more sophisticated, and serve the needs of all of those businesses, you've really accomplished something pretty significant. And with the Chevy Corvette, although it wouldn't normally occur to people to think of a Corvette as a story about value, if you look at the Corvette and the cars that it competes with from around the world, a Corvette, you know, for $53,000 to $70,000, depending on how you equip it, a Corvette gives you the features, the performance, the looks that people are paying $100,000 to $200,000 for in other models. So it's very much a story of value, and a story of a lot of new materials in the case of the Corvette that were used to reduce its weight and improve its efficiency.
You know, Mark, last year, and you mentioned light vehicles improving efficiency. Last year, we talked about the green buzz. I think we've done that the last couple of years. But now it seems like green and hybrids and plug-ins and all those sorts of things become part and parcel of the fabric of the auto show now. And so maybe you don't have the same green buzz, but that doesn't mean that these alternative vehicles are going away anytime soon.
No, not at all. You know, being energy efficient, being green, is the price of admission for automakers these days. No matter what kind of vehicle you're introducing, you know, whether it's a subcompact, you know, passenger car, or, you know, like we were talking, a pickup truck, it's important that it be among the most fuel efficient in its segment when you introduce it, or people won't buy it. It's really been baked into the fabric of the industry, and the biggest movement we're seeing along those lines at the show this year are in reducing the weight of vehicles, because if you make a vehicle lighter, inherently it requires less fuel to move it around, and that, you know, equates to less emissions. So lightweight vehicles and also diesel power plants, which again require, you know, use far less fuel than comparably powerful gasoline vehicles. Those are a couple of the big things that we're seeing at the auto show this year.
My guest is Mark Phelan. He's the auto critic for the Detroit Free Press. We're talking cars, and we're talking the North American International Auto Show. Mark, you mentioned diesel, and we talked about that last year. You've been a big proponent of diesel, not only from the perspective of performance, but also, as you just mentioned, from the perspective of environment.
Absolutely. The general rule of thumb is that with a diesel engine, you get the same, if you compare a diesel to an equally powerful gasoline engine, the diesel will use between 20 and 30% less fuel. And that's just a huge impact. And diesels have been very, very popular in Europe for years. They account for more than half of new vehicle sales there. But they haven't really crossed the line into mass market acceptance among passenger car buyers in America. They're more, you know, used for commercial vehicles and big trucks. But we're seeing more and more passenger vehicles, you know, cars, you know, sedans using diesels. Last year, Chevrolet became the first of the American-based brands to offer a diesel. They put it in the Chevy Cruze, their compact car, and it gets exceptionally, you know, high fuel economy, the highway fuel economy like what you would see in a hybrid from some other brands. And it became quite popular. It joined the German brands in pushing the benefits of diesel. And we're about to see the Dodge Ram pickup, big full-size pickup, add a V6 diesel that comes from Fiat, Chrysler's Italian associate. And later in the year, General Motors is going to introduce a smaller pickup, a couple of smaller pickups. They call them mid-size pickups, the Chevrolet Colorado and GMC Canyon. And both of those will also, you know, feature diesel engines. So in addition to the Germans that have been strong proponents of diesel engines for a long time, we're seeing more penetration into the rest of the market.
As you know, Mark, I'm the proud owner of a Chevy Volt, and I've continued to be very pleased with the car. But I do want to ask you about a specific. We've been talking quite a bit of Chevy. The price point on the Volt has been a bit prohibitive, actually more than a bit prohibitive, particularly for younger people. And then Chevy's come out with this Spark EV, the 2014 Spark, which has a much lower price point. How do you think the Spark's going to do?
You know, it's a delightful little car. Unfortunately, it's not going to be sold, at least in the foreseeable future, in the Great Lakes area. They brought it over specifically for the states along the coast, the East and West Coast, that require a certain number of electric vehicles to be sold. So if you're in, you know, California, Oregon, Washington, New York, New Jersey, D.C., you know, those sort of quadrants, you can get a very good deal on what turns out to be a very enjoyable little car. I had a Spark to test for a week, and the cruising range on it with a full charge is, I believe, around 90 miles, and there were several days when I approached the full cruising range in the driving that I was doing, you know, running errands, going to dinners, that sort of thing, and that turns out to be a very usable distance for you. I didn't feel like I was being limited by the capability of the batteries at all. So it's quite a nice little car, but unfortunately that doesn't mean that it's available to people in our part of the country at the moment.
No, and having just returned from a trip to Pasadena to watch Michigan State win in the Rose Bowl, I do notice on California freeways, and I know you've been out there, boy, there are a lot more electric vehicles. They simply perform better in that warmer weather.
That's certainly a big part of it. The life of a battery is longer when you're in warmer temperatures, until you get to super high temperatures like the desert, and then the battery life begins to go down again. But the brutally cold days that we had at the beginning of the month will significantly reduce how far you can go on a charge in a battery. That's not anything that's wrong with the vehicle or the batteries. It's just simple chemistry, batteries are less efficient at really cold temperatures. So they're a bit easier to use in very temperate places like California. And also they're popular in California because it does require automakers, if you're going to sell cars in California at all, you have to sell some number of electric zero-emission vehicles. And that's a pretty strong incentive because California is too big a market for anybody to sit out of. And many of the electric and alternative energy vehicles are allowed to drive in the carpool lanes on California highways, even if you've only got one person in them. That right there becomes a very strong incentive because the carpool lanes are moving a lot faster. It's funny, they call them high occupancy lanes because they were created to reduce congestion as well as reduce emissions. And there's a certain amount of resentment from some people who are riding along in a very crowded mid-sized sedan and they see, you know, one person zipping by in an electric car when they have to carry a bunch of people to be in those special lanes. But there's a number of reasons that electric cars are particularly popular in California, and all of those things play into it.
What are some other things that folks can expect to see, some highlights of the North American International Auto Show?
The biggest single piece of news is the all-new Ford F-150 pickup. They switched to an almost completely aluminum body for this, and as I said earlier, it's the best-selling car in the country, and they reduced its weight by almost 700 pounds. They haven't told us what the fuel economy figures will be yet because it goes on sale later in the year, but that's a massive step for a kind of vehicle that hasn't really been equated with fuel efficiency and greening up until now. So I think, you know, that on its own is the largest movement at the show.
Well, to read more about the North American International Auto Show, be sure and check out Mark Phelan's work in the Detroit Free Press. Mark, it's always a pleasure. The auto show is underway as we speak. It runs until Sunday, January the 26th. So a whole week for the public to participate and see some of the wonderful innovations. I would say again, we said this last year, Detroit is back.
Absolutely. Come on down, everybody. Have a great time.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
The Michigan State University Department of Radiology is a leader in MRI, imaging research, and patient care. From world-class research to state-of-the-art patient care, we're providing outstanding diagnostic imaging technology. We're also a leader in sports medicine, delivering quality care to athletes and sports participants of all ages. Visit us online at rad.msu.edu and see how we are boldly designing the future.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, it's always a pleasure to welcome back to Greening of the Great Lakes Dan Wyant, who's the director of the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. Dan, we talked about the same time last year, and you said 2013 was going to be a very busy, very challenging year for the DEQ. Let's take a look at 2013. I mean, how did it go for the DEQ?
Yeah, Kirk, thanks. Good to be with you. It was a great year, a lot of accomplishments. We put a focus on three things. We said we were going to see more environmental stewardship in Michigan and not less. Michigan has this great heritage of conservation, environmental stewardship, environmentalism. And Governor Snyder has this vision that our natural resources are fundamental to Michigan's future success, and so we put a focus on that. Two, we said that we were going to be a full partner in Michigan's economic recovery, and the DEQ had a role to play in that. And lastly, we wanted to be recognized as one of the better, if not the best, department in state government. And so on all three accords, Kirk, I think we made progress, and we're pretty happy with some of our accomplishments.
Let's start with one that we've heard about for a long time, and that's regulatory reform. You've reduced policies and procedures. You've tried to streamline processes. You're even helping people understand compliance-related issues. Let's talk a little bit about that and the whole idea of streamlining government.
Yeah, this is what I love about our current governor, Rick Snyder. I've worked for three. He comes from the business background, and he's put a focus on good government, and we've put a focus on cultural change at the DEQ. When we started, we were not the most popular agency in state government. We had a reputation, a lot of it undeserved. So we are good at environmental stewardship. We get the fact that we're there to protect the environment, make sure the water's clean, and that we manage waste, and that our air is clean. But we wanted to be, again, good with respect to making sure people understood our rules. And so a couple things. We've cleaned up over 312 rules. We've eliminated them. We've had 77 recommendations from a committee that looked at regulatory reform, and we've now implemented those recommendations just to make it easier to do business, yet not giving up that environmental protection component. So rules streamlined, processes streamlined, and then a culture of compliance assistance, education, webinars, and trying to inform so that we get people to comply.
How do you assure, Dan, when you're looking at rules and regulations like that, how do you maintain the environmental quality part of it even as you're reducing the rules? Some would argue that a reduction in rules and policies might limit the environmental oversight.
Right. And it's been argued that, and actually just the opposite has occurred. You take the cleanup program, for example. We put greater clarity. We've got clear standards in, and because of the certainty, and because of the education and the cultural change to get people to understand the rules, we're now getting cleanups. We have over 450 contaminated site cleanups in the past year. That is like a fivefold increase over what we had before that. And I will argue the reason we're getting that, environmental stewardship, cleanups of contaminated sites, is because now we've created regulatory certainty with the rules. And I think it's a huge difference. And so here's where it's not one or the other. It's not environmentalism over pro-business. We actually are seeing balance in this equation where we've gotten certainty for the regulated community and the impacted community, yet at the same time we're seeing more environmental stewardship.
Well, speaking of cleanup, and you mentioned that, last year we talked about progress with leaking underground storage tanks, and I know you've made some substantial progress. You got some funding from the governor's budget to do that, and you were really going to ramp it up in 2013. Did that happen?
Yeah, we did. We again, this is a case where two different programs. We have a leaking underground storage tank program, and unfortunately, over time, we've accumulated a number of contaminated sites. We've reformed that program. We had legislative changes, and then we've got additional funding. And so, again, a five-fold increase in that program in addition with respect to cleanups. And so probably most proud of that as a director that we're seeing these cleanups. And it does two things. We protect public health. We eliminate, again, the environmental risk. And then when we do that, we create the opportunity for redevelopment on that site so it satisfies that second objective of being a full partner in economic development. And DEQ is then playing a role in helping the economy recover.
Now, given the progress you made in 2013, are there still quite a few of these sites that you still have to add? And basically, this is a tough one, but how long do you think it's going to take to get them all?
Yeah, well, there's a lot. There's 7,000 sites, and so this is what we're going to do.
7,000.
Yeah, there's a lot of sites that we've got to look at. And so the first thing we do is we've got to ensure that there's no plume or there's no migration of this contamination. We manage risk at every one of those sites, and that's the focus, public health first. After that, we are going to look at development opportunities, try to prioritize these sites. We recognize that there is not an unlimited resource. So we can say today that we got what we call due care plans on every one of these sites that ensure that the public is not at risk. And then after that, we ensure that, again, groundwater and drinking water is not going to be contaminated. And then we're going to start cleaning the sites up. So we'll take the resources that have been provided. And every year we've gotten additional resources from the governor and the legislature to do more. And so I anticipate next year we'll have more sites cleaned up than we did this year, which was a great number.
I'm talking with Dan Wyand, who's the director of the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. Let's move to water and water quality. A lot of issues. Water, I don't need to tell you how important the water deal is. Last year we talked about a water plan coming out of the office of the Great Lakes, et cetera. Is that water plan in place? And I guess there's an advisory committee that has some oversight as well?
Right. John Allen is the director of the Office of Great Lakes, and he's putting together a long-term water strategy. The governor's asked for a 30-year vision on water. We all know this. Michigan's defined by water. We're sitting in the center of 20% of the world's fresh water. Water will be fundamental not only to Michigan's future success, but I believe the nation's future success. And so Michigan has a great role to play. So water is the reason why people come to Michigan to live, to work, and to play. And so we've got three significant issues around water. We've got water quality, we've got water use, and we have this whole issue of the Great Lakes. And invasive species is a big deal. And so on all accounts, we've got initiatives. And so on the water quality piece, we're most proud of the fact that the governor and legislature put $97 million into infrastructure. And so this year we'll be announcing a program for wastewater and stormwater infrastructure improvement. That's a significant investment into our water quality infrastructure. So as we get these great water events and we manage our wastewater, we just got to make sure we treat it. Sometimes we have a pretty significant water event that surpasses the ability of that infrastructure, and so we get raw sewage overflows. It's not something that's very appealing, and it affects water quality, and so we're going to see more improvement there. We're working with our farmers on on-point source controls, a MEEP program, the Michigan Environmental Assurance Program, and others, best practices on farms, filter strips, buffer strips, and so we'll see more stewardship on farms and not less. And so there's an
thanks for bringing that up, because we're going to have Scott Pigott from Farm Bureau on a little later in the show to talk about the success of the MEEP program. Yeah. But I interrupted you.
Yeah, so water quality is big. Water use is just as important. We're seeing, for the first time in certain parts of the state, water shortages, actually, because of water demand. High-volume water with respect to fracking, high-volume water with respect to agriculture use, manufacturing, and, again, just expansion of. And so we just have to be smart about how we manage water. We do have an advisory. We do have an assessment tool. So when we put a well in, we can ensure that it's not going to impact a cold water trout stream and affect the environmental stewardship of an area. And then, obviously, invasive species, probably the one that we lose sleep over the most, because right. Once an invasive gets established, whether it's water or on the land, we as department directors worry about that. And so we're going to see a greater effort to manage our invasive species in the state of Michigan.
Well, you mentioned invasive species, and very timely, Dan, and I wasn't going to ask this question, but as you know, the Army Corps of Engineers has just come out with their latest study, and it looks like separation is an option if you're looking at the Chicago. I haven't had a chance to review that yet, and maybe you haven't as well, but what's your first impression on that?
Well, Michigan is the most impacted, has the most at risk, and the most to lose. It's a pretty significant issue, and so we support separation. We support technologies, whatever it is, to prevent Asian carp and other invasives from coming in. We've got the toughest ballast water standard.
Right.
We'll be very proactive. We're not going to give in on that. Our Great Lakes really are a key to Michigan's success. So we're going to ask for the federal government. We've already seen Senator Stabenow and Congressman Camp ask the Corps to pick up their pace. They talk about a plan that's a 20-year plan. That's just too long. We've got to see something happen quicker. We're concerned about DNA. It's not an indication. A lot of reasons why that DNA could have been found. It's not for sure that there is carp in the Great Lakes, but it certainly is a shot across the bow, and it raises the flag. And so we're going to continue to press to make sure that we're trying to manage that separation, whatever technologies are appropriate to ensure we don't get the invasion of the Asian carp into the Great Lakes.
My guest is Dan Wyand, who's the director of the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. One thing in that Army Corps study that I have read, this separation is a solution that a lot of us think might be the solution, but it's not going to be cheap.
It's not. It has a significant price tag. It's a major investment. And so it's going to take a real commitment. But when you look at the resource that we're talking about, we still feel it's very appropriate. Again, people think about the upfront costs, and it is expensive. But the cost of not only to the sport fishing industry, to the habitat, to other businesses is so significant on the backside that investment, I think, will pay for itself.
You mentioned fracking a little bit earlier, Dan, and who doesn't want to talk about fracking these days? I know that you've been on top of this. Michigan's had a proud tradition, at least in traditional fracking, but now we have this new horizontal fracturing, hydraulic fracturing, which uses more water, a lot of other things. Governor's commissioned a study, I think, out of the University of Michigan, which seems very logical. The science will dictate what we do, I suspect, and DEQ is right in the middle of all this.
Yeah, Kirk, it really is. This is a very important issue for a lot of reasons. It's probably the one the public has a lot of questions about and quite concerned. It's a national debate in many instances. Michigan is a top 10 oil and gas state, and so we do frack in Michigan, and we fracked for many years. Michigan has a model program. We're very proud of it. People need to be aware that we regulate fracking significantly. We're pursuing additional rules. We know that fracking uses a lot of water. We've got to ensure that when water is used, it's done appropriately, specifically water use, so it doesn't, again, affect stream flow and affect the environment. It's not a water quality issue. It's a water use issue. Then there is the quality issue. So when you do put a well in, that the groundwater will not be contaminated.
Right.
And then there's the whole disclosure issue. There is some chemical use, and people want to know what it is and ensure that it's not going to, again, impact the environment. So on all accounts, we're changing our rules. We're in a process now to amend our rules to give greater transparency and certainty. We had a good program. We were confident in our program, but we're going to make it better. And that will happen during this year, and we anticipate. We've put those rules out. They're on our website. People can look at those. There'll be opportunity for public comment. And then on top of that, the University of Michigan does have an integrated process where they bring researchers across disciplines to take a look at what Michigan's doing. And that report is due at the end of the year. We'll have that to draw upon. We have to give assurances to the Michigan public, Kirk. We've heard loud and clear from the public that they need assurances if we're going to frack, it's going to be done in a way that's protective of the environment.
There are a lot of tough nuts there, but just one that you mentioned, and that's the disclosure of the fracking fluids, which is proprietary information. That is a tough one, and there's going to be a lot of pushback, I would suspect, from the industry on that, given the proprietary nature of those fracking fluids.
We're going to require, though, that they do put out 30 days after the frack, on a national website, disclosure of the types of chemicals they use, not the specific brand name. And so we have a disclosure requirement in our rule, and that'll give, again, some assurances. And we think it's good for the industry they do that. There's going to be a need for some transparency. And I'll make the argument to the industry if they don't, they won't develop the confidence that's necessary to keep the public engaged to the point where we can continue to frack in Michigan.
Dan, there's so many subjects we can talk about. You've got some. We've got a mining renaissance in the Upper Peninsula, et cetera, that you guys are on top of. We got some radon issues in Michigan. I mean, this is a whole other conversation. Real quickly, though, a little bit about the mining.
Yeah, there's a renaissance. Mineral prices are up. Michigan has a great heritage of mining, and there are projects ongoing. The Eagle Mine, and there's additional projects in the queue, and so we're going to see more mining in Michigan.
And you guys are going to be on top of it from an environmental standpoint.
You have to. It doesn't have a great track record historically. There's some legacy issues with respect to mining, but two things. Mining is an opportunity. We are going to see mining occur in Michigan. We at the DEQ, again, have to have model regulation in place to ensure that if it does happen, and we feel confident that we can protect the environment. The positive side of this, it's going to be jobs and opportunities for people
right.
in the Upper Peninsula.
Back to the balance of economic development and environment, which is your mantra.
Exactly. And so environmental stewardship, we've got a great heritage in Michigan, but we've got to ensure that we're creating economic opportunity for our communities.
So much to talk about in a very busy year for 2014 for the Department of Environmental Quality. I've been talking with Dan Wyant, the director of the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. Dan, always a pleasure to see you, and Happy New Year.
Kirk, good to be with you. Happy New Year to you.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Please find us on Facebook by searching for Greening of the Great Lakes and follow us on Twitter at Green Michigan.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. We've all heard the expression, it's all about who you know. And wherever you are on your career ladder, having a friend on the inside can make all the difference. When you join the MSU Alumni Association family, you're instantly connected to 500,000 Spartans around the world, many of whom are key decision makers in just about every major enterprise. Whether you're looking for a way in or a way up, your MSU Alumni Association affiliation can help you link up with that MSU alum who'll always take your call just because you're a Spartan. Building your network right now before you need it is the best possible career insurance, and joining the MSU Alumni Association is the best possible way to get the most out of your Spartan life. Learn more online at alumni.msu.edu. That's alumni.msu.edu. The MSU Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, our first guest this week's show recently wrote a very compelling piece on the status of electric vehicles for NewYorker.com. He's also a senior writer at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth and the author of a recent book about dairy farming in the United States. He is Kirk Kardashian. Kirk, welcome to Greening of the Great Lakes.
Great to be here.
Kirk, let's first talk about electric vehicles. I am the proud owner of a Chevrolet Volt, but I have to say, as much as I like the car, I had to agree with a lot. I've been hearing some of the same things that you wrote in the piece. Give us a synopsis of what you've heard about the status of electric vehicles in the United States.
Well, a synopsis, I guess, is that people had expectations that were too high to begin with. There was a lot of hype in the market, in the media, from the government, and that raised expectations about how EVs could fit within the mainstream auto market. And I think people got excited about that. They saw a future of predominantly electric vehicles not too far away. And I think the reality has been a little bit disappointing because the cost of batteries, their long refuel time, their low range has proven, I think, difficult for mainstream customers to get around.
Yeah, the one thing I hear a lot of, and it's particularly from younger folks, we'd love to have an EV, but the price point is just beyond what we can afford. Even with the government rebates, we just can't do it. You got a lot of that feedback, didn't you?
I did, yeah. Even with the federal tax credit, you're still paying quite a premium for an electric vehicle. So you have to really, I think, want one for personal reasons, maybe even philosophical reasons and your values, because I think the payback in fuel efficiency and saved fuel costs, it will come, but it will come a long way down the road. So you have to really sort of be a long-range thinker.
Yeah, I think when you do the math on it, I did that before I bought my Volt, but I'd have to own that Volt for 15 to 20 years in order to reach that break-even point, assuming that gas stays, at around $4 a gallon. And as you know, right now it's well below that. So a lot of folks do it for philosophical reasons. But there's also the range anxiety. What were they telling you with respect to range anxiety?
Well, what I heard is that, what the range anxiety is. It's, the Nissan Leaf has a range of 75 miles before it has to be recharged. So if you're a normal driver and you take longer trips once in a while, I think it's sort of scary to think, well, how am I going to go a two-hour car ride with this EV if I have to stop along the way somewhere and charge it up? That's just not practical for me. So so EVs, I think, make sense for people who have another car that they can use for longer trips, or people who are okay with maybe taking public transportation for longer trips, like a train or something. And then also, people who have a very predictable daily commute that's short, where they can recharge if they need to.
Kirk, after you did this piece, and again, I thought it was very fair and balanced, although some might say that it was a little bit negative towards EVs. I didn't find it that way. But as with any new technology, I mean, what do you think the future might hold as battery technology improves and perhaps we make these cars a little bit more affordable? I mean, do you see that in the future?
I do, but I think it's more of a long-term prospect. And when I say long-term, I mean 10, 15, 20 years. The current forecasts say that a battery in 8 years will cost $6,000 and give you a range of 100 miles versus, you know, today a battery in a Nissan Leaf costs $8,000 and gives you a range of 75 miles. So the improvement over time is going to be slow, but I think we will get there, and I think the charging infrastructure will improve and grow, and I think that just the cost of batteries and the cost of the entire vehicle will come down too, but it's definitely a long-term thing. Conventional gasoline cars are getting more efficient. They are still pretty cheap compared to any other single occupancy vehicle. And if gas prices stay where they are, conventional vehicles, conventional gas is still going to be the prime way we get around.
Yeah, I've had several young people tell me they go to a Chevy lot, for example, and they can perhaps. They look at the Volt at $45,000, and then they look at a Chevy Cruze at half of that price, getting essentially the same kind of mileage, and they say, at this stage of my life, I need to have the Chevy Cruze, and that's the selection that they make. My guest is Kirk Kardashian. Kirk, we were talking about electric vehicles, and one thing in the recent article that you wrote for NewYorker.com about electric vehicles, you brought up an excellent point about we have to think about the source of the electricity that we actually use to power the cars. I mean, how is that electricity being produced? Is it being produced? So I'll go into that a little bit because that's not something people often think about.
Yeah, we think that when you have an EV, it has no tailpipe, and that means that there's no emissions coming from the car. And while it's true that the car does not have an exhaust system, the electricity that feeds the car has to be generated somehow. And depending on where you live in the country, your electricity is being generated via coal, via natural gas, wind, sometimes solar. In reality, the MPG of a Tesla, for example, could vary from 32 miles per gallon if you're juicing it up on coal-fired electricity to 300 miles per gallon if your electricity comes from a solar plant. So there's a huge variation there.
And as we move towards, and hopefully, and I think you share this, as we move towards more and more renewable, then that could eventually be a value added for electric vehicles in addition to any new technologies that may be developed that would make it more cost effective to buy.
Yes, absolutely.
Kirk, in your article, you were talking primarily about all electric vehicles. Let's talk just a moment about the Chevy Volt. As you know, it's electric, and then when the electricity goes, then the gasoline kicks in, which essentially charges the generator, which charges the battery again. Did GM have a better idea, perhaps, than Nissan? Because you don't really get the range anxiety with a Volt.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the Volt fits within the definition of a hybrid because it does have the combination of a gas motor and a battery. So hybrids have found, I think, a really responsive audience out there because you don't have that range anxiety. You do get the fuel efficiency benefit without the cost of the range problem. So. Yeah, I think GM, had a great idea with that, and I think they were wisely trying to appeal to the biggest market they could, and they realized that for the majority of drivers, the range issue is a deal killer.
Yeah, and one of the questions I often get is, well, what kind of mileage do you get with when the gas kicks in? And over the past 2 years, about 38 miles to the gallon when that's charging the battery. So not too shabby.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's. I think that's pretty much as good as you're going to get in most conventional vehicles. I mean, so, you know, some smaller gas-powered vehicles get upwards of 40, but, you know, upper 30s is, I think, is pretty respectable these days.
Well, let's switch. And again, the article in NewYorker.com is Why Electric Vehicles. It was published on October the 23rd, NewYorker.com. People who are interested, it's a great read, by the way, Kirk. I enjoyed it thoroughly. But let's switch over to your book, which came out last year. It's called Milk Money, Cash Cows and the Death of the American Dairy Farm. Tell us a little bit about the book.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't come from a dairy farm family. I grew up in New Jersey. So the reason why I wrote about the dairy industry is because we started taking our daughter to daycare on a dairy farm. And I met this this farm family. They had a small dairy farm where they milked about 70 head. And I got to see what a dairy farm looks like and what it means to, you know, to be a dairy farmer. And I really respected them. I saw that they worked really hard. And then in 2009, when the dairy crisis hit and milk prices plummeted, farms all around the country were going out of business. And it sort of struck me as a dissonant, you know, thing in this country to have people who work really hard produce a great product that people demand, and yet the producer is losing money. It didn't seem like the American way. So that's what caused me to get into that topic. And it was eye opening just to see, you know, how milk is produced and sort of the challenges of being a dairy farmer in the modern market.
Well, you took on quite a task because there are a lot of dairy producers, as you well know from talking to them, who really don't understand how the government price support programs work for their own industry. It's complicated.
Oh, yeah, you're not kidding. It's extremely complicated. And, you know, I still don't claim to understand 100% how it works. And I, you know, I tried to explain it in the book, and I think I was able to get the basic points. But you know, it's federally regulated by the USDA. They use a formula that's based on numerous inputs and factors, and it varies across the country. So it's, you know, it is a complicated thing.
Yeah, it's complicated, and as these milk prices ebb and flow, you're absolutely right. You have a lot of small family farms in states like Wisconsin or your state, Vermont, or even in Michigan. They either sell to larger operators or go out of business entirely, and so you get this consolidation. And frankly, some of these large dairy producers, at least in the state of Michigan, have not been the best players when it comes to the environment or, frankly, to the welfare of their animals.
Yeah, you know, a big part of the book is talking about the externalities that have come from sort of the factory-style dairy farm on the environmental level, animal welfare issues, labor issues. You know, we want cheap food, we want cheap milk, but there's a disconnect between that and the cost on society, which we don't always bear. We don't even know it, actually, because your milk may come from a couple states over, and you don't know what's happening to the water quality in that state. Or it may come from California, and you don't know how dairy farms are contributing to asthma epidemics and ozone pollution and things like that. So, you know, I think there is a cost to cheap food, and it's hidden, so we have to talk about that.
Well, I'm looking forward to reading the book myself. It's called Milk Money, Cash Cows and the Death of the American Dairy Farm, 2012, University of New Hampshire Press. Kirk, we've got about a minute and a half left. You're also working on a book related to a subject near and dear to our hearts here on Greening the Great Lakes, but energy efficiency. Can you give us a snapshot?
Yeah, it's about the future of fuel efficiency and transportation. So, you know, we all really cherish our mobility in this country and around the world. Getting in the car or getting on a plane and going where you want to go. But I think that has led us into a bit of a problem with greenhouse gas emissions and climate change. And I think there's a big question of how are we going to move around in the future in a more sustainable way. And that's what I'm looking into in the book.
And so electric vehicles will be part and parcel of that, but you're probably looking at public transportation, trains, the whole gamut of how we move ourselves around?
Yeah. Private vehicles, trucks, trains, planes, any way that we really move around is sort of fair game for the book. I'd really like to the idea is to give it a personal feel, talking to engineers and people out in the field about their passion for this subject and learning about the science and learning about their own commitment to solving this problem, which is a huge problem.
Well, Kirk, keep us posted when the book comes out. Maybe we can do another interview. We can talk a little bit about that in more depth. It's been my pleasure talking with Kirk Kardashian. He is a senior writer at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth. He's also a contributor to several publications and online blogs around the country, including NewYorker.com, and recently wrote a piece there on why electric vehicles. Kirk, we've covered a lot of topics there, but I appreciate your time. It's been most interesting.
Kirk, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
MLive Media Group is a Greening of the Great Lakes partner. To read Kirk's blog and to hear our show archives, please visit MLive.com/environment.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association, with another observation from the Spartan Life. At an away game this past fall, a Spartan freshman crossed paths with a young woman in hometown regalia. She looked at his MSU green and white and said, "Michigan State, huh? The school you go to when you can't get accepted here." My young friend thought for a moment. His ACT was 34. He earned a 3.7 grade point average in high school. A half dozen top-tier institutions, including hers, had wooed him with scholarship offers, but he decided to attend MSU. He liked the campus atmosphere. He was instantly welcomed as a Spartan even before he had committed. And the university happened to have the number one program in the nation in his area of interest. He thought about a retort, but let it pass. His mother later told me, "I wish we could fast forward 20 years and compare accomplishments." I'm not saying that our young antagonist won't do good things in later life. I hope she will. But it was one more example of how prejudice diminishes the prejudicial. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. wrote these words in his 1965 book, Strength to Love. "Nothing in all the world is more dangerous than sincere ignorance and conscientious stupidity." And all too often, looks can be deceiving. My friend Mike Hudson can pick me out of a crowd of 100 just by hearing my voice. At first glance, many would conclude that he couldn't find his way across a room because of the white cane he carries. Mike leads our Resource Center for Persons with Disabilities. His vision for human potential is crystal clear. "The only thing standing in the way of great accomplishment," he says, "is the limitations we place on ourselves." Mike's daily actions inspire young people to shed the labels of others and do great things anyway. Words can be tools to build self-esteem, to energize high performance, to cement friendships, to articulate and deepen love. They can also be weapons of mass destruction. Actions always speak for themselves. We are bombarded daily by thousands of words intended to influence our behavior. It's easy to be seduced. It's much harder to evaluate people, products, and ideas until we see them in action. What does congressional gridlock tell us about the men and women who have the power to change it? What does a leader's attention to the needs of his employees tell us about his attitude toward his customers? What does the way we spend our time tell us about who we are?
I've had the good fortune to speak with thousands of people about success, high performance, and happiness. My words are insignificant in comparison to the deeds of those extraordinary few who mold concept into action, who do when others just talk, who exude confidence, compassion, and caring from every pore, and make every day a monument to what's most important. In every instance, there have also been naysayers, people who tried to diminish your accomplishments, question your motives, and destroy your character. Remember that what Freud called projection is simply nothing more than trying to cover a strong person's character in a blanket of a weaker person's faults. We've all done this from time to time, but over time, your body of work will become a monument to who you really are. In today's fishbowl of instant internet communication, the veneer of hyperbole is quickly peeled away. And Andrew Carnegie's words are more accurate than ever. As I grow older, I pay less attention to what men say. I just watch what they do. I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. Learn more about Spartans Helping Spartans at alumni.msu.edu.
Sundays at 4 o'clock, it's MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. MSU Today is a lively look at MSU-related people, places, events, and attitudes put into focus through conversations by MSU President Simon, Spartans A.D. Hollis, sustainability-focused Dr. Kirk Heinze, and me. MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on AM 870 WKAR.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman for the MSU Alumni Association. You know, we live in a time where people just don't join things anymore. So why are so many Spartans joining the MSU Alumni Association? Well, perhaps it's our world-class alumni enrichment team, constantly stretching Spartan minds and supercharging Spartan careers. Or perhaps it's our Spartan pipeline, which connects you to trusted friends wherever your adventures may take you. The MSU Alumni Association is dedicated to adding Spartan value to your Spartan life. Whatever it is that may be keeping you up at night, we can connect you with a fellow Spartan who can help. We truly live in a world where who you know is just as important as what you know. And joining the MSU Alumni Association can help you build the relationships you need for success on the job and in every corner of your Spartan life. That's why more and more Spartans are joining the MSU Alumni Association. Activate your membership right now at alumni.msu.edu.
The Michigan State University Department of Radiology is a leader in MRI, imaging research, and patient care. From world-class research to state-of-the-art patient care, we're providing outstanding diagnostic imaging technology. We're also a leader in sports medicine, delivering quality care to athletes and sports participants of all ages. Visit us online at rad.msu.edu and see how we are boldly designing the future.
You're listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Please visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com and join us every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock for MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.